Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage.
Engage.
Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Failing frequencies open, sir.
And we're back. 2017. Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. Hello, it is I, Jordan Hoffman, your host, and we took a little break. We had a holiday break for Christmas, for Hanukkah, for Kwanzaa, for New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. Man, we needed a break that day. Ugh, I barely got off the couch. But now we're back, and it's a whole new year. Brian, the engineer, how are you doing this day?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. And you're in yet another
been a long time.
Yet another plaid shirt. It's good to see you. And we got a great year lined up. This is a big year for Star Trek, a make or break year, because we got Discovery coming to us all in a few months, in about 5.5 months, give or take. The hope is that as we get closer to Discovery, we'll have more guests on the show that are intimately involved in the writing, perhaps in the performing, the directing. There's rumors. I don't want to jinx it, but there's rumors of me getting to know these people pretty well, and that's all coming up down the year. But you know, it's we're now about 6 months into our child is 6 months old, Brian. This show, we started it in June of last year. We've had some great guests in the past from the Star Trek actors. We had you know, Michael Dorn was on the show, Nana Visitor, Ethan Phillips was on twice. Armin Shimerman was on twice. We had Dean Pariseau, the director of one of the greatest Star Trek films of all time, Galaxy Quest.
That was one of my favorites.
Yes, you're a huge Galaxy Quest fan. That was great when he was here. Adam Nimoy was on the show. Why am I telling this? I'm telling you because that was last year. This year is going to be even better. Positivity and optimism for 2017. That's what this show's all about. So thanks again for listening. And if you want to get in touch with me, just to remind you, you can contact the show and me on Facebook at facebook.com/engage the official Star Trek podcast. That's all one word. And you can tweet at me at Jay Hoffman. There was a guy who contacted me via Twitter, and he's like, you should have a Twitter for the show. And I said, well, I'm here, you know, talk to me right now. And he's like, no, you need a Twitter for the show. And I'm like, nobody's going to do it. I'm like, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? Brian, you're a busy man. You're not going to do
it.
I'm
a busy man.
So I'm like, I'm here right now. What do you want to ask me? And he's like, well, I don't have anything to say. I just wanted to say that you should have a Twitter for the show. I'm like, well, you know what? Thanks a lot, pal. I appreciate it. But if you need to contact me, tweet at me at Jay Hoffman. Today's show, the first of 2017, is exciting for two reasons. Number one, we have a great guest by the name of David Mack. David Mack is a writer. He's written two episodes, co-wrote Starship Down, and which was a DS9 episode, a very cool one. Quark disarms a torpedo in that one. And co-wrote It's Only a Paper Moon, which is the Nog Vic Fontaine episode. Is probably better known to Trek fans, hardcore Trek fans, as one of the most established and best of the Star Trek novelists. We've had Dayton Ward on the show before, and David and Dayton work together closely, so David will be joining us in the studio on Deck 44, in just a moment or two. Guy's written something like 35 Star Trek novels, including the Vanguard series, which is one of my favorites. I hope we get to talk to him about Vanguard, and also the Destiny trilogy, and is involved. He is writing the first Discovery book. Should be out at around the same time the show makes it on the air, so in May. We'll be talking to him soon. This episode is going to air air. It's not radio. I know it's a podcast. You can listen to this 10 years from now. But in theory, if you if you're the type of person who listens to podcasts the minute they go live, I just want to let you know where I'm going to be. And Brian, I don't even know if you know what I'm about to say.
I think I have an inkling.
I am going to be at sea. I'm going to be at sea next week. I'm going on the first branded official Star Trek cruise. And I know a handful of people that listen to the show regularly are going to be on. At least three people that I know listened, contacted me when they saw my name in the program. I haven't mentioned this on the show yet because, frankly, I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop and be disinvited. But I am going on the Star Trek cruise that leaves from Miami and then goes to various spots in the Caribbean. It stops in Cozumel, and it stops in other nice ports. But the main attraction is 6 nights and 6 days under the stars, under the high seas, with all of your, not all, but with many of your favorite Star Trek alum. Mr. William Shatner will be on the ship. Ethan Phillips will be on the ship. Marina Sirtis will be on the ship. Terry Farrell will be on the ship. And a number of others. And there's a lot of activities that are going on. Some of them are fairly reminiscent of what happens at a typical convention. There'll be some panels. I'll be moderating many of those panels. There'll be interview ops, photo ops and autograph ops, but also a lot of fun and games. Star Trek trivia, which I'll be hosting. They're doing like a Star Trek family feud where cast of DS9 will be versus the cast of TNG.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's going to be wild. There's going to be a production of the play Love Letters between Terry Farrell and Marina Sirtis. And William Shatner is going to do his one-man show. Joe Piscopo is going to be there doing comedy. You know, he was on one episode of TNG. He taught Data how to laugh.
I don't remember that one, actually.
It's an early... It's the Outrageous Akuna. I think it's season 2. Ugh, I'm just thinking about it. It's making me cough. I hope I'm not sick on the cruise. So that's what's going on. And we're going to record an episode of this podcast with a lesser non-Brian engineer is going to be the guy working it. We'll do a live podcast that's going to be recorded from the ship. You know who my guest is going to be? One of the great Star Trek guests. Goes by the name of TBD. To be determined. We haven't figured it out yet. But somebody. I don't know. We'll worry about it when we're on the boat. I'm thinking maybe I'll ask Terry Farrell to do it because I've gotten to know her a little bit and she hasn't been on the show. You know, a lot of the other people have already, but Terry's never been on the show. So maybe she would agree. You know, we'll see. It'll be somebody fun. So we'll be hearing that episode soon. So that's where I'll be next week on the Star Trek cruise. And then the week after that, I mean, in case you want to keep up with my calendar, I'm going to be at the Sundance Film Festival for my other job, which is writing movie reviews. So, you know, we're going to be banking some stuff today. So that's the news with that. So cool. So another year, 2017. Let's hear it. Let's get energized.
Energize.
And in a moment, we're going to speak to our friend David Mack, and then we'll see how that goes. Real quick, gotta interrupt the show. Have you heard about Blue Apron? Holy smokes, Blue Apron is the best. Let me tell you, it's halfway between ordering out and cooking for yourself. You don't have all the time and the patience to go shopping to get all the ingredients, but you don't want to order out all the time. It's not healthy. It's too expensive. The portions are too big. Blue Apron is perfect. You get all the ingredients directly to you, just the right amount. There's no waste involved. You need one russet potato, not six. You don't have to throw anything out. It gives you the perfect recipe. It doesn't take a lot of time, and bada bing, you're done. It's less than $10 a meal, they say, when you average it all together. And you know, once you're in with the club, you get to kind of customize what you want. So you know, don't take it from me, because what the hell do I know? Make up your own decision. You got to check it out, and you can get take a look at this week's menu and get your first three meals for free. You go with free shipping. You go to blueapron.com/engage, and you get a special deal. Tell them I sent you. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/engage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back. Oh, yes. This is the first episode of the new year of Engage, and we have our first guest. He's right outside the door. Hold on. I think, yeah, I heard him. And where's the door button? Like I said, I've been away all. Coming back from vacation, we're going to beam him in. Yes! Do you like the sound effects?
It's a hell of a sensation.
You've been beamed, David Mack. You've been beamed. Congratulations.
Great. I've had my original form destroyed, and I've been reconstituted in this chair. As a perfect duplicate of the guy who used to write books.
This is the conversation, is do you die when you get beamed? And Mike Okuda, whom I'm sure you've met over the years.
Once or twice.
He said yes.
Yeah. I mean, scientifically, you have to be destroyed to be transported. And that's really one of the things that always troubled me about that technology.
Yeah, well, it didn't dawn. It never came up in the original series. But in the first novel, James Blish's Spock Must Die, which I'm sure didn't even really introduce you yet, but I'm sure you've read, it comes up in that Bones is hypothesizing he's kind of says it, but they don't really come down firmly one way or the other. They sort of like brush it off as just sort of like, you die, and then you
I think clone. I touched on that philosophical conundrum or scientific conundrum in one of my books through the years. In one of my 30-plus novels for Star Trek. And I believe I did have a bit from a character's point of view about why they don't like being transported. And they were constantly wondering, every time they rematerialize, am I the real me? Am I just a copy?
Which character was this?
I can't remember.
Is it the real you, then, is the question, if you remember.
Well, I mean, you just beam me in. Maybe I don't. Maybe the Engram that had that memory got destroyed in the transport process. But I would have to look that up, and since I'm not at my computer, I have no means of doing
so. You cannot consult Memory Alpha right now.
But I'm pretty sure that sequence is in one of my books.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, it's like it's like The Prestige, the end of The Prestige.
Oh, yeah.
As Hugh Jackman is beaming himself into that tank of...
Are you the man who goes into the box or the man who comes out the other side?
Yeah.
And that's the question, is who is transported, the original or the copy? Is the copy left behind and the original moved? Or is the original stay in place, drop through the trapdoor, and the copy reappears elsewhere?
There's no way to know.
There's no way to know.
And once you do it, maybe if it's not the right one, the person who goes through would never want to admit it, that they made a mistake.
You know, it's funny that you bring up The Prestige. My wife always laughs at me when that subject comes up, that movie, because the first time we saw it, I was rooting for the wrong guy. I was rooting for Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, she attributed to the fact that she says I have a man crush on Hugh Jackman.
Who doesn't?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But the thing is, I empathize with his character at the beginning of the movie because it's his wife who dies because of the rope mistake. And Borden seems completely unaffected, or at the very least disengaged from the question of which knot did he tie. And it's not till the end of the movie and you learn the twist that you realize how the accident happened and why it happened. But as a result, through my entire first viewing of the movie, I was rooting for Hugh Jackman right up to the very end and was disappointed when he died because I had sort of gotten so emotionally invested in his story and his pain and his character that the moment where he should have lost me, the point where he says it's not about the trick anymore, you know, or it's not about my wife, it's about the trick, you know, when he loses it on Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. That's the moment you're supposed to realize he's gone off the deep end into obsession.
Right, right.
He's lost it. And when he commits suicide close to 100 times for this one petty act of revenge on Borden, you're supposed to realize this is not a mentally well man. There is no winner. And that Borden, for all of his faults, is actually the better guy you should have been rooting for.
But you watching it...
I the first time through... I rooted for Jackman. I couldn't believe that, you know, Borden actually won. It wasn't until I had a second and third viewing of the movie that I realized, yeah, I was rooting for the wrong guy. I was rooting for the devil.
Well, that was the trick. You got
that
tricked
was the trick.
Rooting for the wrong person. Okay, so David Mack is with me. He is truly one of the great men of modern Star Trek. I want to say that.
Wow, way to oversell it.
No, I'm being 100% serious, because for those of us that are hardcore fans, you know, Star Trek is, we're thinking about Star Trek all the time, and there are the movies and the shows, but the novels are you know, are part of it. And you have not only worked on expanding characters that we know and love and taking them beyond the last episodes of Voyager, DS9, etc., have created characters that are as exciting as the characters we know.
That's very flattering.
I'm speaking specifically about the Vanguard series.
Ah, yes, my favorite.
It is your favorite. I was going to ask you if it was.
It's my creative baby.
Yeah.
I developed that, the series Bible, with Marco Palmieri, the editor. He had the initial idea for Vanguard.
Yeah.
And he brought me aboard to write the series Bible and the first novel. The original idea for the series was to have it be a multi-author series so that it could change author, change tone, change style, book to book, in a way similar to what he had done for the Deep Space Nine post-finale novels.
Yeah.
But very quickly, a dynamic emerged on the Vanguard series. I had set it up in such a way that Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore were going to be the only logical choices to write book two based on the story I set up.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote book two, and then I had really loved what I saw them do in book two, and I voiced to Marco that I wanted to come back for book three. So I came back and did book three, and that got their juices going, and they petitioned him for book four. And Marco realized that it was an opportunity to set up a dynamic that you don't see very often.
You ping-pong back between
the ping-pong
two.
Yeah. Back and forth between an author duo of Ward and Dillmore and then me on the other side. You see a lot of author collaborations where all the authors work together on each book, but it's very rare to see an author collaboration where you ping-pong back and forth on alternating books in a series, almost in a game of one-upmanship.
Right, right.
And that was what we developed on Vanguard.
And all the books ended with, like, a great cliffhanger, and it's like, how
right up to, like, maybe the fourth book, fifth book had a cliffhanger as well. After the fifth book, we realized, okay, we're closing in on the end game. We told CBS and Simon & Schuster that we wanted to end the series on our terms and bring the narrative to a satisfying conclusion. They said, is there any way you can stretch it out, continue it? Because they really loved it, and they thought that creatively it was a very successful endeavor. I mispronounced that. Endeavor.
No, it was successful in Denver. They were.
It was very successful in Denver.
Go to a Denver bookshop. You couldn't find a Vanguard
book. Was everywhere. Yeah. So they wanted us to try and stretch it out a little bit more. And the best we could do on that front, we said, well, we can do an anthology of novellas, like four novellas that together will add up to about a novel-length paperback publication.
What was the name of that? It was
Declassified.
Right. Those were really cool.
Yeah,
we
had a lot of
fun.
They
were prequels.
Three prequels and then one that goes forward from book five. And that was my story, The Stars Look Down. And what was really cool about that is we got to have Marco Palmieri come back to write one of the stories. Marco is by trade an editor. That's what he does most of the time. He hasn't done much in the way of original fiction writing. But as one of the co-creators of the series, one of the visionaries who brought it to life, we felt that the anthology would not be complete without a contribution from Marco. And he knocked it out of the park. His story about a young Captain Diego Reyes on the Dauntless and how he formed his relationship, his friendship with Captain Hallie Gannon when she was his XO, plus great insight into the Arcanites and the Klingons and, you know, that sort of pre-TOS era of Star Trek history. Just a great story.
Yeah.
So we did Declassified, and then we did the final two books where we coordinated the two-part story. We plotted it all out together, the three of us. And then Dayton and Kevin executed the first part, and then I wrote the finale. Yeah.
And there was like a little Coda ebook flying around in there also.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And that was written by Dayton for the ebook.
A little cherry on top.
Yeah, yeah. So
altogether, it's about a decade old, right? It was 2006?
Yeah, it premiered in 2005.
2005, okay.
And it concluded in 2012, I believe.
So still relatively new. And just to give the elevator pitch, if you haven't read these, they're so much fun. And the basic shtick is It's Deep Space Nine set in TOS era.
Which is exactly what makes us want to punch people whenever they say that. That was exactly the tagline we did not use for the series.
Well, I'm saying to explain it to somebody, it's set at a space station. Hey,
it is set primarily on a space station, but it also has multiple starships.
Well, DS9 has the Defiant, too. I mean, come on.
Well, the thing is, we were trying to go for a completely different paradigm in Star Trek, where even on Deep Space Nine, you had the paradigm of commander, first officer, science officer, medical officer, you know, your usual ensemble. Right. We decided specifically to shake it up with a Commodore who has sector command, multiple captains, but then some of our principal characters are civilians.
Right.
We have the reporter, Tim Pennington.
Right.
We have the drunkard soldier of fortune, Cervantes Quinn.
I wanted to get to all these people. Hold on a second. But I do want to defend myself and say to somebody that you have 30 seconds to, it's like, hey, you like Deep Space Nine? You like all these interesting and unique characters and a broad palette of individuals in a spot where there's a lot of danger, but you
and a lot of moral complexity.
And a lot of moral complexity. Because, yeah, Diego Reyes does some stuff. You know,
everybody does. T'Pring. Look at what T'Pring does.
I'm getting to T'Pring. But imagine if all of that was happening in the TOS era. That is unique. And that, I say to you, is an okay way to define it to somebody when you have 10 seconds to do it.
I'm just going to say that right on page one of the series Bible, it says this is not just Deep Space Nine for the TOS era.
Well, I didn't read that.
It's available on my website.
Oh,
it's been out for years.
Oh, my God.
Oh, way to do your homework, Gordon.
I looked at a lot of the pictures on the website. But
you looked at the pictures.
Yeah.
All the pretty pictures. Oh, but the words. Oh, too many words. Boring words.
All right. Words. Fair enough. I concede that perhaps that's not your favorite phrase to hear about what you just referred to as your creative baby.
I understand. It's an elevator pitch. I get it.
All right. If it was an escalator, we would have more time. I'd give the
a little more time
for the elevator pitch. But you did bring up some of these great characters, and I wanted to mention, I was just thinking about this, who were my favorites. And really, one of the most interesting characters is T'Pring.
Mm-hmm.
She is fascinating. She is... what was her official function?
She was the liaison with Starfleet Intelligence.
Okay. So, and she is a Vulcan.
She's a Vulcan.
And?
About 70-some-odd years old.
She has an inner turmoil that we don't learn about at first.
We learn about it actually in the first book.
But not in the, page.
Not right, yeah. It happens about halfway through the book. You get the first taste of this. And the funny thing is, that was actually not in the series Bible. That was a flash of inspiration that came to me as I was writing the manuscript.
Mm.
I was just writing a scene. In fact, I remember I was writing a scene on Christmas night in the basement of my parents' old house where I grew up. I was working on my laptop late at night after everyone else had gone to bed, and I was working on this scene. And I just suddenly hit upon this notion of a Vulcan who has somebody else's Katra stuck in their head.
Yeah.
And I devised this whole backstory for T'Pring, where because she is a gay woman, she was betrothed as a child into one of these arranged Vulcan marriages before her parents realized her orientation.
Mm.
Then you get to Pon Farr and the whole marriage ritual. She petitions to be released from the ritual, but her fiancé, her betrothed, is already in the fires of the Plakto.
Kunit Kalafi, is that what it's referred to?
The Kunit Kalafi is the marriage or challenge.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Basically, you have the marriage ritual, and then you have the blood fever, the Plakto.
Right. Okay.
Her fiancé, Sten, was already in the blood fever, and therefore had reverted to this atavistic form. He would not release her from the marriage vow. So the only way to...
Almost not by choice, though. It's like...
Well, at that point, he was committed. He was already in the fever. It was this or nothing.
Right.
So she realizes the only way out of this, the only way to free him from the blood fever and her from the marriage bond, is to issue a Kunit Kalafi to dissolve the marriage. And so she has to basically fight him to the death. And then... the course of doing so, as she is snuffing out, breaking his neck and taking the last moment of life, because they're in physical contact, in a moment of spite, he thrusts what remains of his Katra violently into her psyche, and there it remains, and they try everything for decades to get rid of it. And so she's haunted by the Plakto, sort of atavistic Katra, you know, this twisted Katra of her dead fiance lives on in her head, warping her moral center and sort of giving her this very dark edge, this inner turmoil, this terrible secret that she struggles to contain.
Yeah.
But it makes her a lot more volatile and it impairs her logic sometimes.
Yeah.
It's the most whacked out thing. It's one of the top five most whacked out things in the totality of Star Trek, I think.
It's a pretty gonzo take on a Vulcan. She's definitely one of my top two favorite characters
so cool.
in the Vanguard series and that I've ever written. Although I did not invent the character, I wrote most of the revelations about the character. The character was first created, I believe, in a Deep Space Nine novel that depicted her death. Sometime in the 24th century, early 24th century. Mm. And it was connected to the character of Prynne, Tenma, and Elias Vaughn. You learn that she was the namesake, you know, that Prynne was named in honor of T'Pryn.
Mm.
But you didn't really learn much about her in that first appearance. So most of what is known about T'Pryn as a character was invented by me for Vanguard. And then my other favorite Vanguard character, and again, just one of my all-time favorite characters I've ever put on paper, is Cervantes Quinn.
Yeah.
Who is a former mercenary, soldier of fortune, down on his luck, drunkard, loser, just a total dumpster fire of a human being.
Yeah.
And he tries to walk this path to redemption, and he almost gets there. He almost has it all, then he loses it all, and goes right back down into the pit where he started from.
And it's a character that you never see in Star Trek, and certainly not in the TOS era.
Not with that level of being broken and violent.
But also being sympathetic. I mean, you see, you know, like you see the Harry Mudds or the Cyrano Joneses or something like that.
And they're treated like a joke.
Yes, exactly. And like Cyrano Jones, he's a goofball, and he's got tribbles everywhere. But Cervantes Quinn is not. He's like, you love the guy, and you want him to do well, and sometimes he does, and he forms alliances with the other people.
He's got a conscience, a strange, you know, sort of moral code that he lives by. He does incredibly selfish, stupid things. On the other hand, he doesn't tend to act out of malice. He acts more out of desperation than anything else. And then in the first book, by the end of the first book, he realizes that he's been used by T'Pryn as a patsy to ruin the life and career of reporter Tim Pennington.
Yeah.
And although he can't confess directly to Pennington what he has done or the role that he has played in Pennington's ruination, he makes a silent vow to himself, I'm going to help this guy fix his life no matter what it takes. And these two wind up as an unlikely pair of best friends, a Felix and Oscar pair, getting into shenanigans and stupidity. Yeah.
Well, Pennington likes to drink also, if I'm not mistaken.
Pennington doesn't mind a drink, but he's not a disastrous alcoholic quite the way that Quinn is.
Right.
Quinn levels it up to an art form. I mean, the other thing Quinn is particularly good at, and you see this in book one, is taking a beating. Yeah. He gets his ass beat in a way that you rarely see in Star Trek, like to the point where after getting, just punched and kicked and beaten, bones broken, left in a bloody mess on the deck, he basically crawls back through the corridors of Vanguard to try and find his way back to a bar that's still open, leaving a blood trail as he goes. Yeah. And all he wants is to just wash down the pain with some tequila. And he's leaving blood everywhere he goes and everything he touches.
Now, there's something else that's in the Vanguard series with T'Pryn, which is her relationship it's very complex. At first, you think it's a human, but it turns out to be a double agent
Klingon. In human guise. Very in the spirit of Arne Darvin from Trouble with Tribbles.
Yeah, Lurkhal is her Klingon
Lurkhal
name.
Is her Klingon name, and she poses as Anna Sandejo.
Right.
Basically a member of the Federation diplomatic team stationed on Vanguard.
Right.
When you first encounter them, I present the scene at first to make you think that it's a fight scene, that in fact that T'Pryn has identified Anna as a spy, which is revealed to the reader earlier in the book, and it looks as though she's about to thrash and beat the hell out of her, and it turns out it's just violent foreplay, because you've got this incredibly repressed Vulcan with this atavistic Katra, you know, fueling her brain.
Right.
And then you've got a Klingon who has relatively violent sexual tendencies as well.
Sure.
And you put
them
together.
But she's got to keep that under wraps.
She's got to keep that under wraps, yeah. But they have They have a very hot relationship.
Well, this is what I wanted to come to, because in Star Trek, which, you know, certainly always had very beautiful people on the screen, and in the other tie-in fiction, there is not much eroticism in the work. And I'm being sincere.
Yeah, they tend to shy away from it.
Yeah, these scenes, they're certainly not unduly coarse.
They're not pornographic.
They're not pornographic. They're not coarse.
They're not descriptive in a graphic
way. But they are, it is erotic. They have a love affair that is tender and true. And when they're together, you know, it's a little steamy. And I'm
very
just,
steamy. Some parts in book three, you know, definitely, you know, missed the windows, missed the viewports, if you will.
Now, I think that's the only, it's certain, I have not read all Star Trek books. I mean, there's zillions of them, but in the ones that I've read, I think this relationship is the only steamy stuff that you'll find out there.
There might be one other exception in my work that I know of, and that is in the book Zero Sum Game, which was part of the Typhon Pact miniseries. Mm-hmm. I kind of went into this territory with Bashir and Serena Douglas when I reignited their relationship and put them back together. That basically, I wanted to show the consummation of their relationship because I felt it was very important to see that this was not just a fling, but that this was a deep physical, emotional, and spiritual connection between the two of them.
Did you get any sort of like feedback from your editors, like, tone this down a little bit, reel it in a little bit, or
no, they both got a big thumbs up, greenlit, no changes.
Awesome.
I mean, I was surprised that the stuff with Lercal and T'Pryn, most of it, in fact, almost all of it, sailed through without any major tweaks of any kind. I remember I did a podcast with some folks a few years back where we were talking about the effect of music as an inspiration on Vanguard. And one of the things I'd used as an example of the difference in psychology between T'Pryn and Lercal, T'Pryn's entire psychology was summed up by the song Number One Crush by Garbage. I don't know if you're familiar with the song, but it's set up, you know, to sort of sound like, you know, the pledges of love and devotion. But as the song goes along, they become darker, more sinister, more stalkery, more violent. Obsessive. It's basically a song about obsessive, fixation on another person. And then for the opposite side of it, for Lercal's point of view on the relationship, I chose What Am I to You by Norah Jones, which is this very sweet, very sincere country love ballad. And basically what was interesting is that in this relationship between the Vulcan character T'Pryn and the Klingon character Lercal, the one whose motives are most pure, the one whose love is most pure, is the Klingon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, spoiler alert, by the end of the book, when Lercal is killed, and basically T'Pryn has to see it happen, she realizes that she's lost, that the only, how did I put it in the book? The only honest thing in her entire life was a woman with two faces and two names. And there's a recurring line between the two of them where Lercal is trying to get T'Pryn to be honest and legit about their relationship. And she's trying to express to her how she feels about her. And she says, you know, I burn for you and I know that you burn for me. And then in the end, Lercal is killed in a bombing incident. And as T'Pryn is watching the starship basically burn and break apart in the hangar bay of Starbase Vanguard, she flashes back to that line, she burns for me.
Yeah.
And it destroys her. And that's the last straw, as you would say. That's the thing that psychologically shatters T'Pryn.
Yeah. And then she goes through a whole
redemption.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that's the theme of the whole Vanguard series. It's all about redemption. The entire series, and a lot of people were sort of thrown by the first book with these deeply flawed characters on the Starfleet side as well as the civilian side. They were all doing these reprehensible things, making bad decisions, morally questionable decisions, operating from the shadows. And a lot of people said, well, this feels more like Battlestar Galactica than like Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a way, that was true. I was a big fan of the reimagined
Battlestar.
And also,
there's the urgency of the, which we haven't even talked about, but the urgency of the thing that's happening.
The Shaddai mystery. Right, and it's also a time of
great... There's a ticking clock throughout all of
Vanguard. There's a ticking clock. There's essentially a mystery that has to be solved. There's an interstellar race between three major powers to try and eventually four major powers to try and unearth and control this alien technology. So there's a sense of political urgency. It's a very volatile time militarily and politically in the Star Trek universe. But then what happens is you've got these Starfleet characters who have to do all these reprehensible things. And to one degree or another, if you look at the first book, it's all about them being set up to fail. Reyes has to start going down the dark side. Pennington sort of cheats. He's been cheating on his wife. He's professionally really great at his job, but he's cheating on his wife. He's having an affair with a Starfleet officer. That officer is killed in the middle of the book. So he's going down this grief spiral, but he's trying to hide it because he can't openly grieve for his mistress. And at one point he winds up, having to deal with, her widowed husband. He's dealing with his wife. His infidelity comes to life, and his marriage falls apart, and she basically takes everything he owns. Meanwhile, to help cover up the military incident that has gone hideously wrong, to Prin sets him up in sort of a Dan Rather-esque, basically, she sabotages him. She torpedoes him. She feeds him what looks like good intel,
but it
finally gets exposed as a fraud, and she basically ruins his career, his professional reputation. And it's as if he has, invited karmic disaster with his affair. Suddenly, everything is gone. In the course of book one, he's lost his reputation, his job, his marriage, everything he owns. And all he has left is one new friend, this drunk sitting next to him on the bleachers. And then you've got T'Pren, who is also doing some very dark things, having a very twisted relationship with someone who is supposed to be an intelligence asset working for her, et cetera, et cetera. And all the characters sort of follow this paradigm, with maybe the exception of Ming Zhang, who represents the conscience of the saga. The entire saga going forward from there is about these characters having to hit rock bottom, most of them in book three, and then having hit rock bottom, having to come back and redeem themselves. For Reyes, it's about, once he hits rock bottom and gets arrested at the end of book three and then vanishes in book four or whatever, for him, it's about trying to build a new piece, trying to build that piece as a civilian that he could not build as a Starfleet officer. For Pennington, it's about getting his reputation back, but it's also about learning to forgive T'Pren, who did this to him. For T'Pren, it's about purging this evil Katra from her head by any means necessary, and then atoning for what is at this point 5 decades worth of terrible life choices. And like at the end of book five, one of the things, or maybe it's book eight, I can't remember, it's either at the very end of the series or maybe when she starts down the journey, she realizes the journey to redemption and atonement for her will never end. It'll never be complete, but that's not the point. Mm. The point is she has to now walk this journey. And, she basically realizes, I will never be done. Yeah. That's not the point.
It's rich stuff. It's really, it's terrific. If the new Star Trek television show, Discovery, if it's an eighth as rich and deep as the Vanguard series, we're all in for a good treat. But one character that did not come up Jetanian. I didn't know that's how it was pronounced.
Jetanian.
Yeah, okay.
Jetanian.
Spelled the same, but okay. I never knew how his name
In
was.
In-house, we always pronounced it Jetanian.
He is a Rigelian...
Chalon. Basically a big walking turtle.
Yeah, he's a big turtle.
He
drinks disgusting-smelling soup, and he's a diplomat.
We modeled him on the Jed Bartlett character from The West Wing.
Awesome.
He always has these remarkable, highfalutin speeches with 50-cent words.
Yeah, he's so cool.
He'll never say in 5 words what he can say in 50.
Yeah. what's great is he's supposed to be a great... negotiator and a peacemaker, but he has
everything he does goes wrong,
and he sits and slurps foul-smelling fish soup, and everybody's grossed out, and they don't want to be around him, even though he's the guy who's supposed to bring peace to the world.
And what's hilarious too is we got a great nod into the movie Star Trek V,
Nimbus 3,
that much maligned film. We actually have them, he and his Klingon counterpart. In a very Waiting for Godot subplot through book five, are sitting basically in like the equivalent of lawn chairs on this plateau, waiting for their Romulan counterpart to arrive so they can get this thing rolling. And they wait and they wait and they wait. And somewhere around like the third or fourth time we get to them, they see a ship come down and it breaks through the cloud cover, this shining thing. And it comes toward them and it hovers just off of the plateau. And the bottom doors open up and light comes out and they're waiting and waiting. And the ship dumps a massive load of garbage onto the planet, then closes its doors and flies away. And the Klingon just says something, "How utterly apropos." And there's just nowhere left to go. And Jatanian just gets up and goes back to his trailer and goes to bed for the night.
Yeah, no, it's very funny stuff.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
You know, you mentioned before about music and the characters. Cervantes Quinn, obviously...
Inspired by Don Miguel Cervantes.
Yeah, I didn't even know. I don't know Cervantes' first name. I guess it's Don Miguel. Yeah, who wrote, of course, Don Quixote.
Don Quixote de la Mancha.
And... Don Quixote's horse,
Rocinante.
Rocinante, the sort of beaten
broken down old nag
with just slumping along with on their dopey adventures.
Rocinante. And that's how we named Quinn's ship.
But I know something about you, David Mack. I know that you are an obsessive of the great Canadian power trio Rush.
Of course I am. The Holy Triumvirate.
As are many Star Trek fans. There is a great connection.
Including Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore, my co-writers on the Vanguard series.
So when you name the ship Rocinante...
It was also a reference to Cygnus X-1 Book 1
yes.
off of the Farewell to Kings LP. And there are many, many references to Rush throughout all of my work, but especially the Vanguard series. But in keeping with the Don Quixote sort of allegory that we did for Quinn, even when Quinn loses his first ship, when the Rocinante is destroyed, and he acquires a second ship that he steals from his longtime rival Zet, he names that ship Dulcinea. Which, of course, is
right.
the name of
yeah, the woman.
Don Quixote's
yeah.
lady.
The shepherd girl who has actually...
Who he thinks of as right. his lady patron or whatever. Yeah. So, but yeah, there are Rush references. There are things like Lamneth Starport. We have things in there called Syrinx, I think.
Is there a Syrinx reference in there?
I think we have a ship called Syrinx, maybe.
Oh, my God.
Or we call something Syrinx class.
And
there's also Battlestar Galactica references. I think in Book 3, some of the intelligence officers are named after producers like Mark Verheiden and some of the others on the Sci-Fi Channel Battlestar Galactica series. There's an Admiral McCreary who is named for Bear McCreary,
sure.
the music
cool.
composer,
yeah.
Whose work was inspirational to me while I was working on all of this. So, but yeah, Rush references run through all of my work, including novel titles. The Vanguard novella, The Stars Look Down. The Stars Look Down is a song title off of Vapor Trails.
Yeah.
Dayton, I think, lifted most of his book titles from Rush song titles. Headlong Flight being just the most recent of them.
What is your favorite Rush album?
Hard to say. I mean, I love so many of them for different reasons, but I think for me, the quintessential Rush album is probably Permanent Waves.
You know, that's a really, really, really good choice because... 2112 is not the best Rush album, because side two of 2112...
Has some weak cuts.
Yeah, it has some weak cuts. Isn't that... On the Train to Bangkok, isn't that...
Train to Bangkok.
That's not the greatest song.
Passage to Bangkok. Passage to Bangkok. I love that song, actually.
It's fine.
Oh, there's a great...
Not...
But the guitar riff, especially in the live version off of Exit Stage Left,
yeah.
The power guitar riff near the end of Passage to Bangkok, that's just classic stuff.
I would say 2112 is their best...
Concept.
Work.
Well, I don't know about
song.
That.
Well, you don't think 2112 is their best song?
No. Well, the thing is, 2112 as a single work, as a concept album, is brilliant to a degree. But I think that if you look at their last album, Clockwork Angels, where the entire album
is
a concept album, I think that you'll see that they actually revisited an earlier concept work, The Fountain of Lamneth, off of Caress of Steel. And you'll find many thematic similarities in terms of the story content and presentation between Fountain of Lamneth and Clockwork Angels. But Clockwork Angels is far more sophisticated,
really,
far more in depth. And I mean, I think it's all worth it on Clockwork Angels for the ending song, The Garden, which brings tears to my eyes.
I gotta confess,
which is really
I've barely listened to it.
It's a beautiful.
I'm a Fairweather fan when it comes to Rush. There's a certain point.
Then you are a rarity. Most people either can't stand the band or they are devoted fanatics.
I'm devoted. You know, the newer stuff, like once you get past, like Roll the Bones, I just sort of didn't pay as much attention.
I can understand not being into Hold Your Fire. Hold Your Fire was not a good album.
Hold Your Fire, there's some good songs on there.
No, Hold Your Fire is pretty bad. That's a lot of synthesizery, dreamy, ethereal crap with no real driving rhythm behind it. I don't think after that they started to come back together with...
And then Neil Peart started drumming differently, right? I mean,
he's always been... Throughout his career, he always was looking for something new. He was incorporating jazz techniques, big band techniques, Asian techniques, African techniques. He was always looking for new time signatures. He was constantly looking to up his game, to level up.
Yeah.
And I think that was what made him one of the greatest percussionists in rock history.
Yeah. My pledge to you is I'm going to listen to Clockwork Angels again very soon.
Skip the first two tracks. Like, you can skip Caravan and BU2B. Start with the title track, Clockwork Angels, which I think is just a magnificent piece in its own right. That, The Anarchist, these are terrific cuts. Then you've got Headlong Flight, which is just absolutely intense. But The Garden has just this very insightful lyric, which was, the measure of a life is a measure of love and respect, so hard to earn, so easy to burn. And if you think about those words, I mean, it really just sums up life in a nutshell. It's so hard, especially in the arts or any business, any field, any aspect of life, to earn respect over time. And respect really does come down, a measure of a life is a measure of love and respect. And it doesn't take much to burn it all down, to destroy your personal life, to destroy your professional life. It's very easy, especially in a modern social media age. Oh, yeah. You can burn your career down like that.
I keep waiting for it to happen myself, personally.
I think back to, the first time we met in person, you ambushed me on a bus in Astoria. I'm coming back from an afternoon matinee movie. I'm listening to, like, my headphones or something, my earbuds. I'm in my own little zone. And then suddenly, there's this big guy standing in front of me going, you're David Mack, aren't you? I'm thinking, oh, great, I'm going to die on a city bus. Wow, that's a fantastic obit. And it turns out it's you, and it was a relatively benign encounter. No, but I got to tell you, getting recognized on the street, that was the first time that ever happened to me.
Oh, really?
Outside of the context of where people normally expect to meet me.
I was on the bus, which you do in New York. Mostly it's a subway, but sometimes you take the bus.
Well, in certain areas, especially the outer boroughs, sometimes a bus makes more
sense.
And
I'm like, that's the guy. And I'd never seen you at a con. I'm like, I recognize that man from the back of the books that I read. I'm like, that is David Mack, great man of Star Trek, author of the Vanguard series, the Destiny trilogy, et cetera, et cetera.
And you knew I lived in Queens.
I didn't know you lived, so I put two and two together, and I say, and I say, of course I say hello to this guy. Why the hell not? What negative?
Because it scared the bejesus out of me. It's why.
Well, I think I don't remember the meat of our conversation, but it was brief and friendly,
Brief and friendly, yes. Yeah. Once I got over the initial shock of being recognized.
Right, right. No, writers don't get recognized, and writers of Star Trek tie-in fiction really don't get recognized.
Very infrequently.
Right, right.
I mean, outside of our, normal captive habitats, when we're sitting behind a table with a little name placard, other than that, you don't normally expect to get recognized.
Well, it should happen more frequently, damn it.
It has, since then, it has happened a couple of times.
Well,
on the street, in a shopping mall, weird places where I never expected to get recognized.
I mean, these books sell. They wouldn't keep hiring you if they didn't sell. I mean, they're not, they don't sell Twilight
occasionally,
books.
I mean, I've made the New York Times list. I've made the USA Today list.
There you go.
Of course, I found out the hard way that I don't actually get credit for that. Star Trek gets credit for that.
That's something else that I wanted to bring up because, and I'm being very frank here, there is a lot of new Star Trek books that come out, and there is a history. There are hundreds and hundreds, probably 1,000 or more. Well, maybe not 1,000.
Closer to about 1,000.
Let's say 800.
The program has been in operation for about 50 years.
Yeah.
So you figure they were sparse at first. There was a period during the 90s when TNG was on that they were publishing two paperbacks a month. And at one point, they were doing two paperbacks a month and also an ebook every month with the SCE line back around 2000. They tapered off, I guess, around the time that DS9 went off the air. But even still, you know, to this day, there's still a new mass market paperback Star Trek novel every month. And I think most months, or maybe every other month, they're doing ebook releases. Mm-hmm. So there's still a fair amount of Star Trek fiction. I think at last count, I think somebody had estimated they were between 750 and 800 some odd officially published Star Trek novels.
Wow. And then, of course, there's all the comics as well, which are great.
Oh, tons.
But the thing is, so sometimes people say to me, like, where do I start? Do I go with one of the classics? Do I read something from the 70s, from the 80s, from now?
My answer is always, well, what show did you like?
Well, that's part of it. And it's interesting because my answer is, you know, do you love Bones? Because if you love Bones, there are books just about Bones, and go crazy.
Sure, pick up Crucible McCoy.
That's the one I was thinking about. But then you go beyond that. Once you start reading them, and this is where it comes to the compliment. This is a long-winded compliment. So sit back. Your compliment's coming your way.
Get
comfy for a second. What it ultimately comes down to is sometimes it's not, oh, I love Bones. This is a Bones book. I'm going to love it. It really is who is the author. Because at the end of the day, it could be a character that you didn't think you cared that much about. But if it's in the hands of a good author, suddenly you love the book. And also, to be fair, not the ones that are being produced now. They're all brilliant. But back in time, not everyone was a winner. There's some from the 70s and 80s and early 90s that maybe aren't as up to snuff. And you decide by who the authors are. And certainly over the years, you know, if it's got Peter David's name on it, it's one you want to read. If it's got Greg Cox's name on it, it's one you want to read. But more importantly, if it's got David Mack's name on it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
That's one that you know, so when...
They do keep hiring me, much to the bafflement of a certain segment of fandom, I'm sure.
Well...
At this point, I found out somebody, I guess, had asked a question. They said, surely you must be the most prolific Star Trek author now. I'm like, no, actually not. And we did an actual count.
Yeah.
Not counting comic books or ebooks, just paperback novels.
Yeah.
I am apparently, at the moment, the third. Third most prolific.
I'm going to guess Peter David's number one.
You got it.
And number two.
This should be easy.
Is it Michael Jan Friedman?
It is.
Hey, look at that.
Peter Clarkson at number one with, I believe, 43 mass market paperback Star Trek novels.
Yeah.
And Michael Jan Friedman, last time I checked, had, I believe, 35. Maybe 36.
And
I'm right now for Star Trek. I'm about to begin writing my Star Trek Discovery novel, which for me is number 27.
Wow. Yeah, that's something I wanted to. I know you can't say anything about the content of the Discovery novel, but.
Sure. I'm still waiting on approval. I've been going back and forth the last couple of days with my editor, Margaret Clark, and with Kirsten Beyer at the show, who is the show's coordinator for licensed fiction.
We came up with a name for her title at the convention in New York. It was we gave her a big, it was on stage. We said something like, she is the admiral of interdisciplinary, contextual blah, blah, blah. I forget what it was exactly.
That's way too many words. Yeah. She's the publishing liaison for Star Trek Discovery.
She's the liaison between the
show. In addition to being a staff writer on the show and a key and essential member of the storytelling team, because of her familiarity with the publishing program, her experience writing novels, it was felt that she was the ideal candidate to serve as the show's point person for coordinating what they're doing on screen with what we're going to be doing in the books.
Yeah, and what IDW will do with the comics also.
Yes, she's also coordinating with IDW. So I put together an outline. There were some basic parameters given to me by Kirsten, which were given to her by the powers that be.
Right.
I put together a first draft of my outline, sent it to her and my editor. The two of them coordinated. My editor basically filtered down all of Kirsten's notes. They arrived at a unified memo, which my editor sent back to me. I've made a revision of the outline based on that memo. I've sent it back to the editor. If the editor is satisfied, it goes back to Kirsten. If Kirsten is satisfied, it goes to CBS. Once I have the green light from all three of the stakeholders, show, licensing, editorial, I will be good to go. I'll be greenlit, and I start work on the manuscript pretty much the moment I get that email saying you are good to go.
It's a fascinating process because you basically know what you're going to write in terms of the outline, but you still have to, you know, there's still work to be done. I mean, there's still a lot of wiggle room to get creative. And
yeah, I mean, well, there are things you discover at the story development phase, at least for me. And then there are things that I find I discover at the manuscript phase. However, when you're working in licensed fiction, you do have to be very detailed in your outlines. Yeah. You have to spell out a lot of the mechanics of how the story is going to work, how the story beats will play out, where the emotional beats are going to be, because all the stakeholders need to know in advance that all of these elements are going to be to their satisfaction. So I have to be very detailed, more so than, say, many authors who work in original fiction would need to be in their own outlines, if they even outline at all.
Right.
Fortunately for me, because I came from a film and TV background, I went to NYU Film School, and then I wrote for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager in the 90s. I was completely trained in the screenwriting model, which is all structure, structure, structure. And it was all about beat outlines followed by full prose outlines. From there, you would go to screenplay or teleplay. So I already had this habit ingrained into me by years of academic training and professional training. And I brought that with me when I made the transition into writing for tie-ins. So it was a really easy transition for me to write these detailed outlines. To the point now where when I was outlining my original novel, you know, a project that I'm working on for tour, I once again had an insanely detailed outline for this epic contemporary fantasy, just because that's how
that's
I
how
work
you do
now.
It. Yeah.
And I find that for me, I know that some writers say if they make that detailed an outline, it uses up all their excitement for the project to the point where they now don't want to write the manuscript because for them, discovering the story is why they write. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's a different style.
But
different
for me, the outline, figuring out the story mechanics at the outline stage, for me is about building a roadmap to where I want to go narratively, so that then the writing of the manuscript is about appreciating the sights and sounds along the way. Mm. That way I've got a roadmap. I never get lost. I don't go off the trail unless I find something really exciting or dramatically promising. But even if I do take a detour, because I have my narrative roadmap already laid out, I usually have a good idea how to get back on the path. Mm-hmm. So I don't go too far astray. I can always ask myself, does this serve the narrative structure that I've already established? I know where I'm going. And that frees me up at the manuscript stage to just go and explore the scene and think about how to filter it, who's my point of view, how does the scene play out, what is the line by line, what are the lines of dialogue. I'm not worried about, well, am I setting something up that I'm going to write myself into a corner and not be able to get out of this three scenes down the road? I've already solved that problem. So I don't have that anxiety holding me back anymore.
So once you've got all your outlines done, when you finally get the, all the three parties say, we approve this, the red stamp, you know, let her rip, starting gun.
Yeah.
How long will it take you then to write a first draft of a manuscript?
It depends. The average for me is about maybe 8 to 10 weeks on a Star Trek novel of 80,000 words.
Wow. Do you take weekends off? Or is
I usually give myself weekends off to see my wife, you know.
You work from home, basically?
Yeah, I work from home, and I try to do a five-day work week.
Yeah.
I try to produce about 2,000 words per work day, so about 10,000 words a week. In about 8 to 10 weeks, I'll have a novel of about 80 to 100,000 words.
Are there some days when you're just like, ugh, I got nothing to say? Or no, because you have this outline.
I have the outline. I know what I have to say. For me, those days are really just a challenge of get motivated, get to work, get it done. Part of the difference between, I think, people who say they want to be writers and those who become writers is realizing that at a certain point, it is not just an art or a vocation. It is a job.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to do the job even when you don't feel like doing the job, even when you don't feel well, even when you're tired, you're distracted, you're upset, your life is going wrong, the country is falling to fascism, everything is going down to hell in a handbasket, and it's all on fire. Guess what? You still have to make your words today.
Well, I mean, if it is your sole source of income, that's a good motivator right there.
Well, fortunately, my wife is employed, so it's not our sole source of income.
All right, fair
if
enough.
It were, we would be homeless and have no health insurance. So I'm in a pretty good situation where, fortunately, I married well.
Right, fair enough.
But it is a situation where I made these commitments to have these books written by certain dates to, you know, essentially to, you know, have outlines done by X date, have a manuscript by X date. And I don't think I've ever missed a major deadline by more than 5 or 6 business days.
Yeah.
And if I ever had a sense that I was going to miss even by a day, I always tell the editor, usually a few weeks out, hey, I'm slipping a little bit on this. I need to push the date on this a week. Can we do that just for safety? And I've only rarely had to do that, and sometimes I do that, and then I come in on time anyway.
Well, this is, you asked before, why do they keep hiring me? That's, you know, I mean, it's...
I try not to make a fuss. I try not to embarrass them in public. I hit my deadlines. Yeah. I write clean manuscripts. I know the continuity. I know the tech. I know the characters. And I try to write a good story that, you know, fans want to read.
So are you... Are you commissioned to do just the first
Discovery novel? I'm not under. That's actually the last Star Trek book I'm under contract for at the moment. When I turn this book in on or before March 27, that will conclude my current contractual obligation to Star Trek.
Okay, and God willing, there will be an extended contract, a new contract, more.
We'll see.
I would imagine so.
If they want me back aboard to write some more stuff, we'll talk it out. We'll see what they have to say,
Fair enough. Cool. Yeah. So, and you know, they're shooting, I think, any minute now. They start shooting.
Now that they finally cast the lead, I think they still have to cast a few of the supporting roles.
Yeah.
We're waiting to find out, like, who's playing the doctor on the Shenzhou and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But most of the major roles are cast. Sonequa Martin-Green is going to be great. I've loved her work. I think she is a fantastic fit for the character I've been reading on the page. Now that I have her in my mind, I go, oh yeah, that's gonna be great.
Yeah. Now I know you can't say anything, but I do love that Doug Jones is involved. I don't know what kind of alien he is.
I do know.
You do
alien.
Know, but you can't tell me.
But I think he's going to be, again, he's a terrific character actor who brings a great fantasy and SF pedigree, a great CV of work behind him. And I think he's going to bring a lot of depth and a lot of pathos to what is going to be a pretty good role for him.
Before we go, because I know that you have deadlines to meet. I don't want to keep you around too long. I have a couple of other notes I want to... Oh, you know, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about. You know, we've been very supportive of the Simon Schuster, CBS, but we know that there's a lot of moving parts to tie-in fiction, as you just discussed, with the different heads that need to approve. And this is not... I'm not speaking out of school. This is something that was discussed and known. You actually wrote a book that was... ostensibly put on ice, ash canned, whatever you want to call it.
It was indefinitely postponed.
It was, you were one of 4 authors.
You're talking about the books that were based on the 2009 Star Trek feature film.
It was meant to come out after Trek 09 and before Into Darkness.
Correct.
And you were commissioned. Greg Cox.
I was writing one. Greg Cox wrote another. Christopher L. Bennett wrote a third, and the fourth was by Alan Dean Foster.
And
all 4 books were written. Mm. They were at various stages of editing and production when the decision was made to indefinitely postpone their release.
And how does that make you feel?
Well, I'm obviously a little disappointed, or very disappointed. I thought that I had done a pretty good job of capturing the unique flavor and style of J.J. Abrams' version of Star Trek, in particular using the elements of continuity from the first movie to tell a story that could only be told within that continuity. And I think that fans who had enjoyed that movie would really have enjoyed my book. And I'm just sad that they don't, that they're not likely to get a chance to read it. I mean, I got paid in full for my work, as I believe all the other authors did. Simon and Schuster basically realized it was not our fault. None of us failed to meet our obligations. All of us completed our contractual obligations on our respective projects, so we were all paid in full, to the best of my knowledge. So I have absolutely no professional beef on that front. The contract says explicitly, you know, there's no guarantee of publication.
Sure.
So my only regret is that I think fans who enjoyed the movie would really have enjoyed my book.
Yeah.
And I'm I'm just bummed that they're not likely to get a chance to read it, at least not anytime soon.
When we get to see Jerry Lewis's the Day the Clown Cried, we can also read these books. It'll be like all the things you can't see. You know, George Lucas allegedly has these art films he's been making and only shows to his friends. We'll see them that day also, you know.
Maybe. I mean, I think at this point, if I were to think about the continuity that was later established in Into Darkness and Beyond, there would probably be a number of continuity errors now between the books and the feature films. And I think that that was a big part of the reason why the books were put on hiatus, why they were postponed, is that there was just going to be no chance, really, to coordinate their continuity with those of the movies. And I feel like it was important to a lot of the stakeholders that there not be this perception of narrative discontinuity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that while it might theoretically be possible with some minor revisions to maybe rework Mine to make it track with continuity without impairing the story too much, again, there just really isn't much commercial will for that at the moment.
Yeah. It's well, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to these things.
There's a lot of issues. I'm not privy to all of them. I don't know all of the factors that maybe went into the decision to pull the books. But really, my only regret can be that I thought I wrote a book that fans of the movie would have dug, and I'm just sad they don't get to read it. I mean, it's not my property, so I had a couple say, well, can you just put it up online or whatever? And I'm like, well, no, because I don't own it. It's a work for hire. The moment I set words to paper while I'm working under contract, those words belong to my employer. Yeah. The finished manuscript is the property of Star Trek and CBS, and it is not mine to give away.
You could maybe speak them. You could go to a park and speak them out loud.
That would really be pushing my luck, I think. I don't think I'm going to do that.
I don't think I'm going to do that. Fair enough. You know, you mentioned earlier that your favorite characters were Cervantes, Quinn, and T'Pring. Your favorites to write of your own. Who are your favorite characters to write that are established Star Trek characters, not your own creation?
I've always enjoyed writing Data. I liked writing Worf. Had a lot of fun with those guys. On the DS9 side, obviously, I seem to have developed a strong affinity for writing Bashir. I just seem to relate to him, which is why at this point I've got a whole Julian Bashir super spy novel arc, starting with Zero Sum Game, and then continuing through A Ceremony of Losses. Then he appears in something else, and now there's the Section 31 books, Disavowed, and coming in March is Section 31 Control, which I'm currently thinking of as the end of my Julian Bashir super spy novel arc.
All right, so we're putting
that's the big conclusion.
And which, I don't say ones you don't like writing, but the ones that you, the character of pre-established Star Trek that you find the most difficult to write for?
I don't know that it's so much a difficulty as just a matter of not feeling a sense of inspiration or connection with them. I've never really felt much of a connection with Troi, although I did try to get into her head with an emotionally meaningful story in the Destiny trilogy. Odo has always been a bit of a mystery to me in terms of how to write him. While I had fun writing some stuff with him in spec scripts when I was pitching to TV, on the novel side, his character post-finale just went in a direction that I just didn't feel comfortable writing.
He goes back to the Link.
Yeah, he went back to the Link.
Went to the bad guys.
Well, yeah, but then there was a whole post-finale exploration post that of him and another character, and David R. George did some work with that, and Marco had a whole vision for where that was going, and then he got laid off in the 2008 economic meltdown, and all those plans basically got flushed and went up in flames and yada, yada, yada.
They went in the bucket.
They went in the bucket.
They went in Odo's bucket.
They went into Odo's bucket.
Cool. Well,
that would be a name for a podcast. Welcome to Odo's Bucket.
All right, cool. So you have the new Section 31 book, which will be out in stores and on Amazon, Kindles, and all that in March, you say.
Yeah, March 28th, I believe, is the street date for that.
And the first Discovery book is allegedly
tentatively scheduled to come out around the time of the show's premiere. That's what I'm being told.
We're told May.
End of May would be my best guess.
Awesome.
And then I have a Titan novel that I've already finished writing that's now in production. That is scheduled for sometime around the end of the year.
Oh, okay.
End of 2017. And then in early 2018, February 2018, will be the premiere of my new original series, Dark Arts, coming from Tor Books.
Did you mean this was the modern day fantasy?
Contemporary thing? Fantasy. Okay. Book one is set during World War II. Mm. Basic, you know, like if you were going to look for the elevator pitch, it's Captain America meets Lev Grossman's The Magicians.
Awesome.
And the idea is you basically, you know, you had Hitler with black magicians working for the Axis. So the Allies, Churchill, decide that they need magicians working for them. So our main character, a young man, an American studying at Oxford, is recruited into a top secret magical warfare program known as the Midnight Front.
Sounds awesome.
And the Midnight Front is the title of book one. And as soon as I finish writing the Discovery novel, I am going to be starting work on the second book in that series. Mm. The second book is titled The Iron Codex. And that book is set in 1953. It's a Cold War espionage thriller, again, with black magicians.
Same characters?
Same characters.
But a little older.
Because
unless they're traveling through time.
Well, no, because of black magic, you slow the aging process. Oh. I'm using, essentially, one of the conceits for the Dark Arts series. I'm using Renaissance magic on the assumption that it works the way it says it does in the old grimoires, like the... you know, the Lemegeton, the Clavicula Salomonis Regis, et cetera, so that you make all magic is predicated on the summoning and control of demons. And you make these pacts, you know, you sell your soul, et cetera, and in return you get 700 years of life, you know, and certain immunities and whatever. And then I added a little twist to it that fans will see when they read the book as to make it a little more cinematic. Mm. But I basically predicated it on this very classical view, this Renaissance era view of black magic. And essentially I'm using black magic as sort of this avenue for secret history, and I'm going through 20th century geopolitics. And at its heart, the subtext of the whole series, assuming it goes beyond the first three books and is able to continue, is to go through various periods of 20th century history and track the rise of fascism in the West.
Oh.
to see how we went from fighting fascism in World War II to voting for fascism in 2016.
Well, hopefully the last book in the series will be the 2020 reversal.
We'll see.
That.
We'll see. I mean, by 2020, I'll be lucky if the third book is out, by which point we'll only be up to 1963, the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
Well, the other fun thing about the Dark Arts series is that I'm also envisioning it as a series where each book, by jumping into a different era of history with a different set of priorities, is a different style of book. The first book is a World War II war epic.
Mm.
The second book is a Cold War espionage thriller. The third book will be a conspiracy piece.
Right.
And then if the series continues to sell and Tor wants to continue it...
Mm-hmm.
Book four would either be Summer of Love or early 1970s,
okay.
And that would probably be like a crime thriller with the mob and, you know, stuff like that, dirty underground type stuff.
Yeah.
80s would be a corporate, you know, corporate heist book type of thing.
Well, I think the 80s should be corporate heist, but set in like early computer programmers, and you might be able to have a cameo of three gentlemen from Toronto that you're very fond of.
You never know.
Could maybe show up.
Well, one of my hopes is that, you know, if I can do book four and set it in the 70s, I wanted to have a scene where we catch up with the main character at a Led Zeppelin show where he's whacked out on heroin, you know, and he's at the show that's being taped for, you know...
Song Remains the Same?
Yeah.
Awesome. That would
Have him listening to, you know... The drum solo.
Moby Dick.
Yeah, Moby Dick. Moby Dick!
That is an almost Rush-esque riff.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, Rush and Led Zeppelin were contemporaries to a certain, you know, right through the 70s.
Do you consider Rush to be more... See, because Rush gets lumped in with prog rock a lot. And
but they came out of a blues rock tradition originally. I mean, they were inspired by, you know... Mr. Soul and Cream, Yardbirds. I mean, they came out of a strong blues tradition. They were a bar band before they were a prog rock band.
And like bands like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and even Jethro Tull and Renaissance. And I feel like Rush is a little bit... there's just like something a little different that separates them from those other ones, you know?
I agree. I think that Rush is sui generis. I think that prog rock was simply the most convenient label that, you know, Rolling Stone had to paste on them to explain why it wasn't going to cover them for so many decades. But I think that really at heart, Rush is just its own thing. They've always been musical pioneers. They've changed their style every couple of albums. A fun thing, if you look at the overall discography of Rush, you find that their evolutions of style tend to occur in two album bursts. So that the first album, the eponymous Rush, and Fly By Night, thematically, structurally, sonically, are very similar albums. But Fly By Night is a little more refined, a little more polished, better studio time, a little more money behind it. But you can feel like it's the same sonic ideas that are just being worked out and refined from album one. But then comes third album, Caress of Steel, the much maligned Caress of Steel, which led to the Down the Tubes tour, as the band puts it, where they thought their careers were over.
There are a couple of good songs on Caress of Steel.
Hey, I think I'm going bald. I love that song. What a great song.
And but the Necromancer is
on
that,
right? I'm in the vast minority. Yeah. I love the Fountain of Lamneth.
Yeah.
And I don't care who knows it. But the thing is, that was their first foray into the idea of the concept album. Sure. So they have the concept side, Fountain of Lamneth, and then you have the B side with the singles and other tracks. Mm-hmm. And then, what is the second pair in that discography? It's 2112.
Right.
Again, another concept album, A side, full concept album side, B side, individual tracks.
Sure.
But more ambitious, more polished, more refined, but also really just a great distillation of everything that the band realized.
And
that
great
they
compositions,
were,
too. I mean,
great composition.
Very
great orchestration, terrific arrangements, really. But again, what you see is that they're taking the ideas that were being worked on in Caress of Steel, and the ideas evolve into a more refined form at 2112. Now you have a live album. Now jump. Now you've got Farewell to Kings. We're not doing a concept album anymore.
I thought Hemispheres comes next.
Farewell Kings was next.
All right.
Farewell to Kings was the next studio album, and it preceded Hemispheres. Now, Hemispheres, again, is semi-concept album. You have another concept side, which they didn't do on Farewell to Kings.
Yeah.
But this is where they start working in more synthesizers, a little bit more of an electronic sound. Those two albums, sonically, have a lot in common. They're very much a brother-sister pair of albums.
Mm.
And then, of course, you jump forward, and what's your next in progression? Permanent Waves.
Right.
Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures. Again, I sort of love Permanent Waves just a little more than Moving Pictures, which is weird because Moving Pictures is their big crowd-pleasing hit, Tom Sawyer, etc. But there's a purity, there's a sonic cleanliness, sort of a just a an austerity of sound, if you will, to Permanent Waves. But Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures, again, function like a sonic pair. They have a lot of stylistic similarity, the length of the different tracks of songs, the shying away from the concept album but having a couple of longer tracks, Natural Science versus say The Camera Eye. Then Evolution Time, after another live album, now evolution into the strong synthesizer sound of Signals, which then is refined into Grace Under Pressure.
Right.
After this, you have Power Windows.
Which I love, by the way.
Power Windows is a great album.
Great. Marathon is like one of their best songs.
Oh, yeah. Territories.
Yeah.
You know, Big Money.
Yeah.
Big Money Got No Soul, man.
But that was almost MTV pop, a little bit Power Windows.
Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little new wave.
You see this as you go through, that there's always this sort of duality, that, you know, there's always this pair of albums. And if you look at them each as a duology, new idea, new break, you know, new attempt at a style renovation, a style revolution, and then refinement of idea is the next step.
Yeah.
And then it's always, and let's reinvent again.
Yeah.
And it happens in two album bursts all through their career.
Now, is this a by design?
I don't know that it was by design. I think it's just, it's a function of the passage of time and a sense of they were always on the lookout for new sounds, new ideas, new tempos, new time signatures. Yeah. And I think that they were just constantly trying to push themselves to do something that they hadn't done before because they didn't want to bore themselves doing the same album over and over again the way that some bands do. Rolling Stones. So they forced themselves to reinvent and do something that's just stylistically different, sonically different,
yeah, yeah.
So that you see these, again, these pairings come through. And I think it continued right up through, you know, Vapor Trails and Snakes and Arrows. And then you have that, you know, sort of last studio album, Clockwork Angels, where if you listen to it, there are little sonic callbacks through the entirety of Clockwork Angels to the entire span of their career that preceded it.
So they knew that was going to be their last album.
I have a feeling that even if they weren't conscious of it, I feel like on a subconscious level, they knew that it might very well be the farewell album. It plays like a farewell album, particularly The Garden. If you listen to The Garden, the finality of it, the fact that it represents, you know, the cultivation, you know, the culmination of a life's journey and a life's wisdom distilled down to a single track. I mean, the first time I listened to that track, I got misty-eyed because I had a feeling. I'm like, I think this is it. I think this is a farewell album. Yeah.
How many times have you seen them live?
I've been to at least one show on every tour since Signals in 1982.
Wow. So
I've probably seen them 20 to 30 times, which for, you know, among the true diehard Rush fanatics is nothing.
Sure.
But that was as much as I could afford. I didn't have the budget or the luxury of following the band around multiple shows on every tour. Much as I would have loved to have done so, it just wasn't in the cards. But I did make sure that I saw them for the first time on the Signals tour when I was about 12, 13. And at that point, it just sort of, the band became my religion, and I'd never missed a tour. I made sure that I caught at least one show on every tour since then. So anytime they went on tour, I made at least one show.
But touring with them, they're not a band like Grateful Dead or Phish, where they change the set every night. They pretty much locked it in.
They pretty much locked it in. So if you went to like five shows on the same tour, you saw the same show every single time, with only maybe the most minor variations. They started getting a little more whimsical and loosening up a little bit with some of the improvisations in later years. I remember that from what I had heard from other fans, there was, I think it was it the Time Machine tour? It was either Time Machine or Vapor Trails. They had La Viola Stranjato was part of their closing medley.
Mm.
And every night there would be a different improvisation by Alex, in like a spoken word improvisation. And whatever struck his fancy, whatever was on his mind, if he'd had a dream the previous night, if there was just something he wanted to say, he would just go off on like a weird little tangent. And I think, you know, I forget, he was talking in something very New York. Like when I saw them do that in New York, there was something very New York about it. He was talking about wandering through Central Park and this and that and the other thing. And it was just the strangest little diatribe that went on for like 3-4 minutes. But then there's a great bit from the version they recorded for the live album. I think maybe it was it the Snakes and Arrows tour? I have to look it up. But there's a bit where he's making fun of Getty, who is playing like Girl from Ipanema, and he says, you know, making all these weird, these are the voices in my head, singing is so easy, you know, blah, 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 blah. That's jazz is weird. And it's because he's a funny guy.
He's a weird guy.
He's a funny guy. I only got the chance to meet him and Getty one time. Well, I met them a couple of times doing meet and greets, but the one time I consider having met them was getting to hang out backstage for about an hour post-show.
Oh, wow.
On the Vapor Trails tour, I believe. Was it Vapor Trails? No, it would have been Snakes and Arrows, 2007. Hanging out at the PNC Bank Arts Center with Getty and Alex and, you know, basically their little entourage team, whatever. That was pretty cool, and I didn't get to meet Neil, but
he doesn't like to talk to fans.
He doesn't like to meet fans. He doesn't like to meet strangers, and I certainly can't begrudge him that.
You're not going
to
talk to him on a bus and say, "Hey, I recognize you."
No. He's, but I was able to bring an autograph book for him because I had named a character in his honor in a couple of my Star Trek novels, and I gave copies to Getty. Getty said he would make sure that they got to Neil, and about, you know, a couple months later, I got an email from Neil.
No joke.
It was very, very short, polite. Yeah. He said something to the effect of, you know, it's very strange to see a book with a character, you know, with my name in it. I don't see that very often. Thank you for the honor, whatever. And I wrote back, the honor was mine. You know, if I ever get the chance, it would be great to, you know, buy you a drink and, you know, share some scotch with you. And that's the extent of it. Even though I technically have his email address, I've never been presumptuous enough to think that I had any right to use it.
One day you will. One day you're just going to like come up with a brilliant insight into...
I keep hoping that I will do something that he will read, that he will like enough that he'll drop me another email to say, I read that. That didn't suck. Yeah. Nice job. And I'll write back, thanks. That'd be great. I'd like to buy you a drink. And then I'll not hear from him again for another 20 years.
Well, you know... You know, for, I would say most Star Trek fans are either Rush fans already or they should and they just haven't been exposed. So I feel perfectly fine devoting this much time talking about Rush. La Villa Strangiato, by the way, which you mentioned earlier, if for those listening who maybe haven't heard it, go to Spotify. It is this epic, I don't know, 8.5 minute instrumental track that's impossible to play, and it nearly broke the band when they tried to record it all in one take. And
it's a great example of their virtuosity as musicians.
It's great. It's better than YYZ, I say.
YYZ.
Oh, that's right.
They're Canadian.
Yeah,
remember?
YYZ. You know, it took me being a fan of Rush 15 years before I realized why YYZ is called YYZ.
It's the airport code for Toronto International.
I discovered that the first time I flew to Toronto.
Did you know that the percussion on the cymbals is the Morse code for
that
YYZ?
I knew. That I just assumed.
And it's used for the airport locator signal.
Yeah. So the
That's Morse for YYZ.
That's YYZ. Got that. But I'm on the plane going to Toronto for the first time in my life. And I'm looking at my ticket. It says YY, and it was like
ding.
My head was like, and like I was alone, so I couldn't say anything to anybody. But I'm like, oh my god, I get this! I get this now. 15 years later, this is so exciting. All right, cool. Well, listen,
Shokoth, his eyes uncovered.
Right, exactly. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming by. This was a lot of fun. If you're listening and you haven't read some of David's books, you can. Also, the Legacies trilogy. We had Dayton Ward on a few months ago, so we spoke about that.
Yeah, the 50th anniversary thing, which I was part of.
You were part of it. I just finished. Greg Cox was first.
Yeah, Captain to Captain. Mine is Best Defense, book two. And then Purgatory's Key is book three.
I haven't read book three yet, so I'm still stuck on the planet with all of them. But,
well, hopefully, you know, I'll be able to come back in March or April, and we can talk about Section 31 Control and the whole Julian Bashir super spy novel arc and how all that came about. And
that'll be fun. We should definitely do that.
It'll be rife with spoilers, and then maybe in May we'll... talk about Discovery.
Because
once people have actually had a chance to see the first two episodes and read the book, I'll actually be able to discuss the content of the book.
I know.
Which would be so lovely.
It's exciting. It's going to be great. I have nothing but positive thoughts, and we're all looking forward to it. So, once again, thanks. And people can find you on the internet. You're on Twitter at... What is your Twitter handle?
David Allen, A-L-A-N, Mac.
All one word.
All one word. David A-L-A-N, Mac, M-A-C-K.
That's the best way to contact you via
That's the easiest
internet.
Way to find me on Twitter. And you can also find me on the web at davidmac.pro. davidmac.pro. And there's links to my social media and stuff off the front page and off the press page and yada, yada, yada.
All that good stuff. So I am going to send you off with, Captain Picard is going to say...
Make it so.
And we are going to see you next time.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Awesome.